It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll see how innovative transportation options in Milwaukee compare with other cities around the country.
First, recent shootings in Madison have highlighted an uptick in gang-related activity in the city. Gunfire outside a Madison mall over the weekend brought attention to what many people think of as a big city issue.
But police are quick to point out that gang activity isn't a new thing, and no city is immune from it. For more information about gangs and what can be done about them is Lester Moore. He's a neighborhood officer on Madison's east side, and he spent 10 years as a gang officer with the Madison Police Department. Officer Moore, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, people might think of gangs as a big city problem. In Wisconsin, maybe we think of Milwaukee. What are some signs that there is gang activity in other places around the state, including in Madison?
Well, one of the things that you can see is by the increase of violence among young people today. You can see the way, if you look at television programs and movies, you can see that gangs and gang behavior is a popular theme in a lot of those shows. But mostly, if you are talking about young people, all you have to do is pay attention to social networking. The way that young people represent themselves and what they believe in on social networks will give you probably the biggest clue about how big the gang issue is. I mean, for a person that's not involved in investigating gangs or is not involved in the gang world, whether it's through intervention and prevention work, if you have absolutely no idea about gangs, I would say, looking into social networking will give you a good idea about how involved young people are in gang activity in the state.
I know this is a big question, but what is it about gangs that attracts young people? What draws young people in?
That is a question that everyone's been asking for many years. For the number of years I've been working gang since 2004, and that's always the big question. And I think that one of the things that I've seen, and, I'm a parent, and so it's kind of one of those things that whenever your kids are behaving outside the normal behavior, then that's something to think about. That's something to look at. Just, something other than normal. Our abnormal teenage behavior, as we know, of young people. But, things like defiant behavior at home and hanging out with a new crowd of friends and having wanting to be called by a different name other than their own. And if you just look at some of the stuff that they scribble on papers and getting into trouble at school for sticking up for other kids all the time, getting in fights at school for sticking up for other kids in unusual circumstances. Those are some of the things that I think you can look for that will point you toward maybe my child or a child that I know is involved in gang activity.
So when, say, a teen joins a gang, is that something that they're going to be affiliated with well into their adult years, or is it something that usually comes and then goes as they get older?
I think that's on a case-by-case basis. Each individual is different. I've seen kids that have been involved and then have gotten out of the gang lifestyle and gone on to be, productive people with kids and having a career. And I've seen other folks get involved and stay involved and well into the time that they become grandparents.
And the rumor, at least watching on popular culture, is that it's very dangerous to leave a gang. Is that true in real life?
I think that it is with certain groups. It depends on what group you're with and how, what their level of commitment for, keeping the gang together is. There's always that threat. There's always a threat. They have a saying in the gang world called blood in, blood out. So that means that you get initiated in and you get initiated out. And from what I've known from some of the more serious gangs, and even some of the, not so more serious gangs, the ones that are just starting, the initiation out is definitely more violent than the initiation in.
In many cities around the country, there are networks of gangs involved, not just in violence, but in drug dealing activity. Is that something you see, at least in the Madison community, an affiliation between gang and the drug trade?
Well, that was pretty common that, gang members would be involved in the drug trade. But, after, investigating and conducting, analysis of gangs and collecting intelligence on gangs. Not all gang members sell drugs. There are other things that gang members can do. And there's other things that gangs do to get money. There are robberies. There are home invasion type robberies. There's burglaries. And the new thing that we're seeing now is human trafficking. The trafficking of young girls. So that's a big thing that we're seeing gangs being involved in now in this state.
Well, I want to talk about some possible solutions. Let's start on the police side. What can a police department do to turn back the tide, try to keep gang activity down?
It's a very small slice of the pie that the police have. And when I say that, people always say, wow, gangs, it's criminal activity. And the definition of a gang is three or more people with a common identifying sign, similar name, whose members are either individually or collectively engaged in criminal activity. And so the criminal activity part of that is what separates, a criminal street gang from the Girl Scouts, it's the criminal activity piece. However, that's the part that the police address. And a lot of it is reactive. We react to what they do. But in Madison, we had developed a four-pronged strategy to deal with gangs, and that was intervention, prevention, suppression, and reentry. So intervention and prevention is talking to kids and parents and keeping kids from getting involved in gangs. And then kids who are involved in gangs, we need to get them out. And how do we do that? And then there's the suppression piece is which is our really big piece of the pie, just suppressing the activity, making it difficult for them to operate by taking away anonymity and knowing everyone that's involved and who they're connected to. And then the reentry part is people coming out of corrections, adults and juveniles coming out of corrections, trying to do better. How do we help them do better? This is a big strategy, and police can't do this alone. That's why we network with a lot of people in the community, from social workers to nonprofits like mentoring programs, like Mentoring Positives, other folks like Voices and Visions Beyond Bars, Nehemiah, organizations that help people coming out of the correctional system. So there's a lot, and that's just Boys and Girls Club. There's tons of people out there, and there's too many to name that have a piece of this neighborhood intervention program through Dane County. There's a lot of people who have a piece of this pie. That is called gang activity, and what you really want to do with gang activity is get to the root cause, and those root causes are poverty, I think lack of education, kids wanting to belong to something. How do we tackle that? And it's not something that the police can do alone. It's a community effort, even a religious community, and even someone's grandparents that want to get in and want to do some mentoring or develop some apprenticeships for young people to learn something different. Everyone can help with this problem. It's a community problem. It really is. But as far as police officers, what we do is we get out, we get to know who's doing what, and many times we intervene in a situation and keep it from happening. And then sometimes after that situation happens, we have enough relationships with community members and people that people trust us, and they come and tell us what's going on, and that helps us to quickly wrap up investigations when possible.
I wanted to ask more about that community side. If someone is living in an area, a neighborhood, they're concerned that, hey, it seems like there's starting to be some gang activity, what are some of the most useful things they can do to get involved in a positive way?
Well, they say that communities who communities where people have relationships with one another, that is the key to lowering violence in a community, because everyone knows everyone. So you kind of don't want to commit crime in a community where everyone knows you, So getting to know your neighbors and getting to know, people at that level that neighborhoods used to be, I think that's one of the keys that people can do. And people can be active in their neighborhood associations, looking out for one another and recognizing issues as they come up. And so, and when you have a concern, get a hold of someone that can help you. Whether it's your churches or your community programs or even your police department, so you can start coming up with ideas in order to deal with that issue.
And in Madison, where there have been some shootings lately in the papers, the department has cited flare-ups between gangs. How does the approach as a police officer change when we have this kind of flare-up between a gang that can lead to shootings or other violence?
You know, we're constantly, gangs are constantly evolving, so we're always working. We're always out there developing information and relationships with folks. So sometimes you can't prevent these things from happening. Many times, one of the programs that we do with the Madison Police Department, and it was an officer, Greg Rossetti, who actually originally started this, that home visit program where, you know, kids that were having problems in school or involved in violence, you know, from in the returning school year, we would go and do home visits with folks and, you know, kind of get to see where they live and kind of get to know their story about who they are and connect with parents and family members and people who are influential with those people, so that if we do have a problem, you know, we can talk to someone who has influence with that person, and maybe we can stop that problem before it happens. But once, you know, you have something that happens, it's about going out and getting it solved and identifying who's involved. And I think because of the relationships that the folks in the gang unit have been able to develop, and folks in neighborhoods have been able to develop, and even your patrol officers out there on the street have contacts with people that we can go and we can ask what's going on. And many times, if your relationship is great enough, people will call you when after something has happened, and sometimes before it happens, and let you know, hey, you know, I trust you. I just want to let you know this is going on. And, you know, and hopefully you can use this information. Information is the key to dealing with this on a police level, I think. You know, it's you never know when this one piece of information can be important. So we try to collect the information and use it the best way that we can to number one, deter. But, you know, once the situation has occurred, we'll use that information to try to conduct effective investigations and assist, our detectives and our districts to solve those crimes.
Officer Moore, thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Officer Lester Moore of the Madison Police Department talking about what can be done to quell gang violence in Wisconsin communities.
The rise of technologies like rideshare and bike share services has made getting around without having your own car in many of the country's urban areas a lot easier.
A recent report from the Wisperg Foundation actually looks at the availability of these new transportation services in the country's 70 largest cities. Milwaukee ranked 15th in the nation. The top three American cities for transportation innovation, according to the report, are Austin, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C.
Here with us to talk about transportation innovations in Milwaukee is Peter Skopek, Campaigns Director at Wisperg, the Wisconsin Public Interest Research Group. Peter, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this is the first report of its kind looking specifically at how new technologies can reduce reliance on cars. Why is this the right time to be looking more closely at this?
Exactly. So our report ranks 70 of the biggest American cities on how many new technology services and tools they have to help meet transportation needs. And so we compared the cities based on the presence of these technologies and concepts, so things like ride sourcing, like Uber and Lyft, bike sharing, but then also apps for navigating public transit on smartphones. And the reason that this is important, and again, we found that Milwaukee was ranked 15th among these 70 cities, and that puts Milwaukee really at the front lines of mobility and innovation here. But the reason this is important is because the way that we're getting around is changing. So in the bigger picture, our findings show that technology is really contributing to a revolution in how we get around all across the country, including in Wisconsin. We're just driving less these days than we have been in the past, and these new technologies are making it easier and more convenient for more people to live full and engaged lives without needing to own a car, and that's a big change. That's a big change in many parts across the country.
Now, you said Milwaukee was ranked 15th, which puts it at the head of the pack, and it's still not number one or in the top three. So, where is Milwaukee doing especially well, and where does it stand to gain a little ground?
Sure. So Milwaukee ranked in the top category, really, of cities that we looked at. So it's in what we called the category of cities with abundant choices when it comes to technology-enabled mobility. So there are eight different services and tools in Milwaukee from a number of different providers. So Milwaukee really ranks quite well. So some of the services that Milwaukee has are a municipal bike share program called Bubbler Bikes. There's also ride sourcing, so those are the services called Lyft and Uber. There's car sharing, like Zipcar. You can hail taxi cabs using your smartphone. There's Google Transit, real-time bus information. So really, a lot of different services that are already provided in Milwaukee. There is some room for improvement. So more different services could be provided. More different service providers could be brought to the city. Things like one-way car sharing could be implemented as well. But generally speaking, Milwaukee did really well in this report.
Now, these technologies are clearly serving a need, but they can also be expensive. You need internet access. A lot of times you need a smartphone. What does that mean for poorer members of a community like, say, Milwaukee?
Sure, that's a great question. And one of the reasons why these technologies are taking off is because these things like internet, broadband access, smartphones are just becoming more and more widespread. So the reason that these services can take off is because more and more people have access to those technologies. And in terms of providing services for segments of the population that don't have access to those technologies, we certainly have to do more to make sure that there's good public transit. I mean, that's really the number one way that many people are getting around, and many people who can't afford to drive are getting around as well. And in a larger sense, we just have to make sure that we're investing our resources not only in driving and expanding, building bigger, newer highways, but also that our public transit needs are being met to serve those populations as well, connect those people to jobs and services, to the doctor's office, to the grocery store.
Now, with Milwaukee, did you zoom in at all about where some of these services are available? Things like Uber and Zipcar and bike sharing, are they, do you find, available in some of the more economically challenged parts of the Milwaukee?
Well, these services are generally available in the urban area. It gets more difficult to kind of the farther out into the suburbs you go. This is something that we saw across the country in many places. The farther out you go, the harder it is to have access to these different services. But we didn't necessarily study specific parts of the city where these technologies are more available than in others.
Now, a lot of these that we've talked about, these are private services. Do you see a bigger role that municipalities could play in expanding availability?
Sure. Well, there's a lot of room for municipalities to work together with some of these companies. So some of the recommendations that we make in the report for policymakers is we think the policymakers should be encouraging collaboration between public transit systems and then these new technology mobility companies. So, for example, encouraging bike sharing and bike sharing locations close to train stops and to bus stops, having ride sharing and car sharing in those areas as well, so that you can, for example, take the bus in from the suburbs or take the train in from the suburbs and then get on a bike that's available through Bubbler, for example. There's also an opportunity to just really expand the availability of real-time information through the public transit system to make it easier to track where buses are and make it more convenient for folks waiting for the bus to know exactly when it's coming. And then also, we think that policymakers should be adopting clear rules and guidelines for these new services to make sure that the public is fully protected, and also allowing the services to know what the rules of the game are in that city or in the state.
Do you have a sense of who's using these services so far in Milwaukee?
That's a great question. And these services are being largely used by young people, by the generation called millennials. So those are people who were born between the years of 1983 and 2000. So typically, young people, it's usually been young people who've adopted newer technologies faster than most parts of the population. So whether it's cell phones or whether it's using the internet several decades ago, or starting to use these kinds of services. So these systems and these tools are being used especially by young people and by millennials who are making choices to live in places where they don't need to own a car to be able to get around. And so as a city, this is also important, because if you want to attract and retain these young, bright minds, you increasingly have to provide these technologies and make it easy for these technologies to be around to make it possible to live without a car or to live a car-light lifestyle.
Have you looked at any of the potential downsides of some of these new services, things like Zipcar and Lyft have been a little bit controversial because they don't have to follow the same guidelines as conventional taxi services. For example, they might not make a provision for the disabled, or they might have surge fees during high traffic periods. Are there some disadvantages that can come along with these that need to be ironed out yet?
Yes, absolutely. And as I said, I think one of the really important things for decision makers to do and for our policymakers to do is to come up with really clear rules of the game to make sure that that these companies understand how to interact with consumers, to make sure that consumers are protected from potential bad actors in the marketplace, and make sure that that there are really clear rules for operating in these marketplaces. So that's definitely something that has to be done and that we have to keep following and be aware of.
Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Peter Skopek, Campaigns Director at Wisper, talking about a new Wisberg report ranking Milwaukee 15th among the country's 70 largest cities for innovative transportation.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Take a walk through your local supermarket or pharmacy, and you'll notice one thing in particular. Vitamins are everywhere. Many are prepackaged as foods and labeled as vitamin-enhanced or enriched, and supplements and vitamin pills promise us better health.
We know that we need vitamins, but besides that, what do we really know about them? According to our next guest, we don't really know much about them at all, and that's a problem. She says our faith in vitamins, combined with the philosophy toward nutrition they've enabled, could actually do us harm.
Catherine Price is with us now to sort out vitamin fact and fiction. She's an author and journalist. Her new book is called Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, the word vitamin gets tossed around a lot to the point where a lot of us aren't exactly sure what a vitamin is compared to all the supplements, and you toss that into the mix as well. So what is a vitamin?
Yeah, that's a great place to start because I personally definitely confused the two terms myself when I started this project. So vitamins are not the same thing as dietary supplements, even though we often use those terms interchangeably. Vitamins technically refers to just 13 dietary chemicals, and that's A, C, D, E, K, and then the 8 B vitamins, which are also called things like thiamine and riboflavin. And those are chemicals that we need in order to prevent specific deficiency conditions, and which we normally have to get from our diet. And that's much different from the larger, much, much larger category of dietary supplements, which is an estimated 85,000 or so products. And those are the products you see when you walk into a vitamin shop or GNC or even your local drugstore where there's a whole aisle of bottles with all sorts of stuff.
Is vitamin deficiency in its various forms typically a problem in the United States, for instance?
Well, in the United States, we're lucky in that we don't have that high, I mean, we have very low rates of real deficiency diseases, so you're not going to find many people with scurvy, for example, which is vitamin C deficiency. Beriberi, a thiamine deficiency, is basically so unfamiliar that most of us don't even know its name. But, you know, there are people in the United States who do have micronutrient deficiencies, including vitamins, so it's not something that we should just forget about and pretend doesn't, or just think that doesn't affect us, because it's always possible to have a vitamin deficiency if your diet is poor.
Well, once vitamins are actually in our body, that we take in that vitamin pill or that supplement, do we know what happens?
Well, we know some of the purposes of the vitamins, and we also know some of the ways that they work. You know, we know, for example, that vitamin C is essential in order to produce collagen, which is a connective protein that pretty much holds our bodies together. And so if you don't have vitamin C, you can't make collagen. You get the deficiency disease of scurvy, and you basically start to disintegrate from within. It's a horrible disease that thankfully we don't have a problem with. But it's interesting to me that even if we know what deficiency diseases they prevent, there's still a lot that's unknown about the mechanisms. Like, for example, vitamin A is really important in our immune systems, but we don't yet know exactly how that works.
Now, so despite being officially discovered about a century ago, you say that we really don't know all that much about vitamins. How can that be? Why is there still so much left to know?
Well, I think that part of the problem is nutrition is really difficult to study, and there's a lot of interactions between things that make it hard to tease out exactly what's happening, so that would explain why we still don't know the details of some of these reactions in our bodies. But my point with that sentence was more that we, the public, don't know as much as we think that we know. And when I say I mean like us personally, and then what we like to assume nutritional scientists know. Because one of my personal reasons for writing this book is that one day my husband turned to me and he asked me, what's a vitamin? Just kind of out of nowhere. I mean, I guess because I write about nutrition. And I opened my mouth to try to answer him, and I realized I actually did not know the answer to that question. And I thought, I can't believe that here I am, I think I was like 34 at that time, and I, you know, took Flintstones as a kid. I ate total cereal. I'm very familiar with the idea of a vitamin, but if you actually pressed me, I couldn't tell you very much about them at all.
Why is that? So when there's this booming industry, people are taking vitamins thinking that will do them some good. And in some cases, you point out, they do a lot of good. But why is it that we don't have better education about the function of vitamins?
I don't know. I think part of the reason has to do with the word itself. I started getting captivated by the word vitamin because the word vitamin was only coined in 1911, and it was by this Polish biochemist named Casimir Funk, and he was studying beriberi, which is the thiamine deficiency disease, but he didn't know that at that point. And he basically made this word up without anyone having isolated a vitamin out of food, and with a lot of controversy still going on about the whole concept of nutritional deficiency diseases. And he just took two words, vita, which is the Latin word for life, and amine, which is the chemical form that he thought all these compounds would turn out to be, which they didn't. And he lumped it together, and he called it a vitamine with an E. And it eventually got shortened to vitamin. But it was such a controversial term. Like, the other researchers at the time didn't think it would stick around because it didn't really mean anything. But it did because it's such a good word. And so to get to your question, I mean, it got picked up by food marketers, and then the public embraced it because it just sounded nice. And I think that part of the reason we don't ask more questions is it just seems so healthy, you know. And if you think about some of the alternatives for what other scientists wanted to call these things, things like food hormones or accessory factors. First of all, I don't think we'd have an obsession with the accessory factors, but
right.
We probably wouldn't just accept that as readily or be attracted to it in the same way that we are vitamins.
Right. So it's got the vita part in the beginning, suggests good health. But so when did the word vitamin itself become to be synonymous with good health?
Well, I think that happened actually pretty early on. I mean, in part because when it was coined, there wasn't, you know, no one had actually isolated a vitamin. But starting in the 1920s, you started to have two things happen. First of all, some of the scientists who were actually studying the vitamins, who really were nutritional chemists at the forefront of discovering these things, they started to write about vitamins in the popular press. So this one guy in particular, Elmer McCollum, from the 20s to 40s, wrote this really popular column in McCall's, in which he was telling housewives all about this new science of vitamins, not really like pointing out how undeveloped this knowledge was, and also making it seem like if you didn't have enough vitamins, you were immediately going to get scurvy or rickets, neither of which were really a problem in the States at the time. So it instilled this kind of sense of fear in the American public about deficiency. And then you also had marketers realize, wow, this is a great term, and you can't taste vitamins and you can't see them, and at that point you can't measure them. So if we can figure out that our food contains some sort of vitamin activity, we can make some really great marketing claims, and no one can actually fact check any of them.
And we've got, you know, food that we can eat, which contains the vitamins. On the other hand, we've got this booming industry of vitamins that we can take to, you know, hopefully shore up our deficiencies. But is there a problem with people subbing one out for the other? I guess in this case, subbing the vitamin pill in for the food.
Well, yeah, that's an important question to ask. And again, to clarify, you know, we're talking about the vitamins, like the 13 vitamins, not dietary supplements, which is a whole different subject. I would say in general, I'm personally not that concerned about the difference between synthetic and naturally occurring vitamins, because they mostly act the same, and there actually are cases where the synthetic form is easier for us to absorb than the natural form, for instance, folic acid or vitamin B12. But what I do see as a problem is that, first of all, a lot of times marketers will use the presence of vitamins in a food to make it seem healthy, when if you actually took a step back and looked at the underlying food, it's not really that healthy. I always pick on breakfast cereal for some reason with this, but breakfast cereal being an example. The other thing is that foods that naturally contain vitamins contain a thousands of other chemicals that might be beneficial to our health and that we don't really understand and that are not put back into fortified foods or into vitamin pills. And so if you just eat food, just if you just get your synthetic vitamins from fortified foods or pills, you're missing out on all this other stuff. And I think that that might have long-term effects on our health that we don't understand yet.
But taken by itself, is there anything wrong with adding vitamins along to your complement of daily food nutrition?
Well, I think it depends what level you're doing this at. I mean, if you're taking vitamins at levels that could be replicated in food, then I don't know if that's necessary because you also could get them from either natural foods or fortified foods, but you're probably not doing too much bad to yourself. But I think that you get into a murkier territory when you start taking real super doses of vitamins and assuming that it'll either do something good for you or at worst be neutral. Because not only have there been studies done that show that's actually not the case, like high levels of beta carotene over time actually increase the incidence of lung cancer among smokers in a number of studies. But, you know, we just don't know what some of the long-term effects, more subtle effects of these constant superdoses might be.
Well, there has been a lot of research about vitamins, and sometimes it seems to seesaw back and forth. Sometimes people say, well, basically, you're taking these vitamins and you're just, you know, peeing it out, frankly, at the end of the day. And others who say, you know, look at vitamin D. This may have a protective benefit against breast cancer, and it's important to get enough of it. So how do we know what the right course of action is here when it comes to taking vitamins?
Well, yeah, the tricky part is it's a case-by-case basis, and there is so much that's unknown. So I would say to keep in mind a few things, that superdoses in general I don't think are a good idea. That's particularly true when you get to the fat-soluble vitamins, which are A, D, E, and K. The reason being they're the ones that dissolve in fat, and they get stored in your body tissues, and you actually don't pee them out as readily as you do the others. I'd say also to just recognize how much is still unknown about vitamins and nutrition overall. And so if you see a new study that comes out and it's saying that vitamin D, I don't know, prevents breast cancer or can make you fly or whatever it is, recognize that that's probably based on preliminary science. It may be true, probably not the flying thing, but, you know, there may well be benefits beyond what we know. But if it's grabbing headlines, then it's probably pretty new, and I wouldn't recommend changing your diet based on that. And then in general, just trying to aim for levels that you could get from food. But, I mean, D is an interesting one in that many people believe we weren't originally supposed to get it from food because it naturally occurs in very few foods. Like fish liver oil is an excellent source. But beyond that, like the D in milk is a synthetic addition. And instead, we actually make it in response to sunlight on your skin. So that's an interesting one where the experts themselves really don't have many answers about D, even to the point of defining what deficiency is or knowing what it does beyond helping with bone health. So there may well be, you know, there's exciting research going on with D, I guess, and I think that it is difficult to always get enough from our food. So that one is, it's just an interesting, particularly interesting one to me, how to balance those, what we know and what we don't know.
Well, we're talking right now with author and journalist Catherine Price about the wide world of vitamins, what we know about them and also what we may not know about them and the effect it could be having on our health.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you make it a point to take vitamins, maybe a multivitamin or some vitamin C? Are you confused by some of the claims surrounding vitamin supplements? So what questions do you have about vitamins in food or pill form? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Catherine Price. She's the author of Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the vitamins you take? Why do you take them? And what would help you to be more informed about vitamins in general? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Randy joining us from Sauk County. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, hi. First of all, I agree with the most everything that your presenter, and I've heard her before. I think it's a wonderful thing that she's done. This is my question. A number of years back, my physician wanted to know exactly if I might have some vitamin deficiencies. So he said, why guess? And I went down to the UW. They drew about 30 vials of blood. I think it was more blood than I'd ever seen. And they sent these things all over wherever there was a lab. And when the reports came back, I was fine on everything, but one or two I was deficient on. As I took those one or two, various health issues related to them were solved. What I don't understand is why make it theory? Why not advise people to get their blood tested?
Interesting point. Thank you, Randy. So I guess we can find out if we're deficient and then just treat what we may be deficient in with a blood test. Is that reasonable?
Well, you know, I'm glad that that worked for you. That's great. I think the reason I don't specifically recommend that is that in a lot of cases, it's actually really difficult to measure the vitamins in our bodies. For example, vitamin A, if you wanted to get a really good sense of how much vitamin A you had, you'd have to get a liver biopsy, which is not really a pleasant-sounding thing, to me at least. And other ones like vitamin C or folic acid, for example, fluctuate a lot, or D for that matter, actually, depending in the case of C, for example, if you just ate like a lot of grapefruit, you're going to be off the charts with vitamin C, but then a week later, when you didn't have the grapefruit, you wouldn't be. So it can be difficult to interpret the results. So that's really one of the reasons I don't talk about that too much, but I'm very happy that that worked for you. That's great.
Thank you for that call. And we're going to go next to Sarah in Neenah. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I had a question. I guess in the past when I have taken vitamins, I mean, I took Flintstones when I was a kid. My mom gave them to me. And she always called me the sick child. I got sick all the time. And then in college, I took multivitamins regularly because I wasn't necessarily eating the healthiest at that point in life, being a poor college student. And whenever I got used to it, it's like my body got used to taking the vitamin. And then if I stopped taking it, even for a day, I would get sick. And now that I'm an adult, I don't take any kind of vitamins whatsoever. I just am careful about what I eat, and I exercise regularly, and I rarely get sick anymore. Do you know if there's any sort of connection between the vitamin and how often you have it, and if you can possibly become sick? Can your body get used to it and, you know, need to have it at some point if you take too much of it?
All right. Thank you, Sarah. An interesting question there. Is that what's going on with Sarah, or has she just gotten old enough that she's developed immunity to a whole bunch of viruses?
Well, that's a good question. I guess you could have just gotten sick so many times in your past that now your body has all the antibodies to keep you protected. I mean, I would say that scientifically, I don't think the vitamins are what was doing that for you. There could be a placebo effect, though, where you associated taking the multivitamins with this protective effect on your health, and placebo effects can be very powerful. So I can't really speak to what exactly is happening, although I would say I don't think it's because of the multivitamins.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Sarah. And next, we're going to go to Mary in Heartland. Hi, Mary.
Hi. My ophthalmologist has prescribed eye caps, which when I read the label, there seemed to be very high levels of A, C, E, and zinc. I mean, E was like 1,333%, which I guess is of the daily requirement. I'm really concerned about this. Can you speak to that? I haven't started to take them yet, but...
Okay.
I'm not familiar with that particular product, but I do think it's a good idea when you see products that have amounts in that excess of the recommended dietary allowances for you to ask questions. So I think it's a good idea to ask your doctor a bit more about why they're prescribing that, and to try to do a bit of research on your own about what is actually known about the effects of that in your condition. I don't know of any reason that you need to be taking that much E, and there have been some studies that high levels of E over time are not good. So I think your caution is warranted, and I'd encourage you to try to do some research, for example, with the National Institute of Health website, and also talk to your doctor. But it's okay to be cautious. I think that's a good idea.
Mary, thanks a lot. I hope that helps. And Catherine, let's talk about those daily allowances. Everyone's heard the RDA. You're supposed to get, you know, X percent, you know, from each day in your food or your vitamins. What do we know about how useful those figures are?
Well, it's a good point to make. So the RDA stands for Recommended Dietary Allowances. And we tend to think that they are a target each of us should be trying to hit every day, because it has that 100%. We all know in high school you're supposed to hit 100%. but in reality, they're not meant to be personalized. They're population-wide recommendations, which means they're supposed to try to cover pretty much everyone in the population, 97 to 98% of us. And what that means in practice is that 97 to 98% of us could be totally fine on less. if that makes sense. It's like having an oversized sweater that is going to fit 98% of the population. Chances are you'll fit into a smaller size, but you need to make the recommendation pretty broad. So I'd keep that in mind. It also is not meant to be every day. It's just your average consumption over time. And also, these are based on science that's constantly evolving, so you can't really, it's not a hard and fast thing. And in terms of the numbers on your food and supplement labels, those are actually based on pretty outdated versions of the recommended dietary allowances, mostly from 1968. So take those numbers with a grain of salt. Don't think that if your supplement says it's 100% of everything, that it's A, based on the most recent science, or B, personalized advice for you.
Having looked into vitamins closely and our sort of cultural belief, and you know, we call it an obsession, is there a better way that we can start thinking about nutrition and health and vitamins along with the whole package?
Yeah, I mean, I used the term protective diet when I was trying to figure out a way to think about this in a different sense. And actually, it's interesting. This term, the protective diet, was coined by a nutritional chemist named Elmer McCollum, who's from Wisconsin. So you guys have a personal connection to him. And he was the one I was mentioning who wrote a popular column for in McCall's magazine. And he endorsed this idea of a protective diet. And what he meant by that is just eating foods that naturally contain vitamins, like a lot of leafy greens and fruits and, you know, in his case, a lot of dairy products, as he did a lot of work with dairy. But basically the stuff that you and I have heard forever that we're supposed to be eating. And he said that not because there was, like, tons of scientific evidence behind it, but because you couldn't really measure vitamins, so you kind of had to just, like, hedge your bets and eat foods that they knew contained some but didn't really necessarily know the details.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Catherine, okay. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
We've been speaking with Catherine Price. She's the author of Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. Some cool news out of northern Wisconsin. A unique Wisconsin landmark is open to the
public. Ice caves are back. Woo!
Hello.
Oh, sorry. I get excited.
A little
They're
early
really
celebrating
cool.
there.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Apostle Island Ice Caves opened up to the public this weekend for the first time this winter. Over 12,000 people made the hike from the parking lot over the ice of Lake Superior and into the caves.
The caves got worldwide attention last year after amazing pictures of the ice went viral. Last year, we talked to Bob Krummenacker, National Park Service Superintendent of Apostle Island's National Lakeshore. The caves last year were already open in January. He told us it was a unique experience.
To the best of my knowledge, there is nowhere else on this lake and possibly anywhere in the world where you can have this particular experience. So I'd say get this experience and then get as many other Lake Superior experiences as you can as well.
Right. I remember this interview well because he also recommended heavy boots, warm clothes, and to be ready for a 1 mile hike on the ice with water undulating and rocking the ice as you walked over it. And we all sort of thought,
Undulating ice.
Sounds very cool. And yet.
Well, let us know if you went this weekend or if you see it in the next week or two, as long as it's open. Just send us a message, maybe a picture too, over on the Central Time Facebook page.